start out and introduce yourself and tell us about your organization.
My name is Edward Hammond, and I'm the director of the Sunshine Project. We're a small nonprofit organization with offices here in Austin, Texas, and in Hamburg, Germany, and we work in the area of biological weapons control, and in particular, we have a focus on preventing new types of biotechnology from being used in for hostile purposes or being used in the creation or development of weapons.
And I would imagine biodefense is a big part of your focus.
Sure. One of our major research areas in recent years has been the U.S. biodefense program, and of course, this is because a lot of biological technologies that have peaceful purposes that may be medical or for animal health or for agriculture can also be abused for the creation of weapons. And it is unfortunately the case in the United States right now that we are conducting a large amount of research which is designed to defend us from biological weapons. But unfortunately, in the process, we tend to actually develop a lot of knowledge and capacity that is related to waging biological warfare. And the effect of this internationally can be destabilizing because other countries don't necessarily see such benign motives as most Americans do, certainly as our government does, in some of its most advanced research with diseases designed to defend us.
Dual use technology was a term we used when talking about Iraq. Would that term apply to what you're talking about?
Sure. I mean, really, dual use technology, what the phrase means is that there are a variety of techniques and types of knowledge and innovations that can be used for peaceful purposes or that can be used as weapons. I think a familiar example to a lot of people might be the drug Botox, which is botulinum toxin, which is a very potent biological weapons agent. If it's used in very minute quantities, it can also remove wrinkles from your face. However, the facilities, for example, that manufacture botulinum toxin for pharmaceutical purposes are largely the same as the facilities that you would use if you were going to manufacture it for a weapon. So these kinds of facilities and knowledge that have application to either offense or defense are of concern internationally because it's really necessary to be transparent and above board and sometimes to exercise restraint in what you do in order to reassure other countries that your intent is peaceful.
The biodefense industry got a big boost in funding after 9/11 and the anthrax attacks. Can you give us a sense for how large that is?
Sure. Well, the United States actually already had the largest biodefense program in the world before the anthrax attacks, and since then it has jumped enormously. I think conservative estimates put the amount of money put into biodefense since 2001 at between $14 and $15 billion. Some of those estimates, however, don't fully account or don't attempt to fully account for classified programs or work in intelligence agencies. So it may be that the actual figure is closer to $20 billion that we're investing. In other words, perhaps $7, $8 billion a year going into an activity that prior to September 11th and the anthrax letters received probably something less than $1 billion a year. So at least a tenfold increase, if not more.
My understanding is that a lot of organizations and universities wanted to get a chunk of that money. Would that be correct?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's to begin with, it needs to be said that our response in terms of the amount of money that's being thrown at the problem in hopes for a solution is disproportionate to the threat. And also, at the same time, the federal government doesn't frequently offer such enormous amounts of money for bricks and mortar, for example, to universities and other institutions across the country, nor does it so liberally fund what were previously, in many cases, rather arcane areas of study. So what's happened is a couple of things. One, there's a gold rush among institutions to get this money to build fancy new buildings and high containment labs. And secondly, you see researchers who previously did work that had nothing to do with potential biological weapons agents rushing in to do work with, you know, agents like anthrax because there's a huge amount of money there. And what that has created among, you know, nonprofits and citizens groups is a tremendous concern at several levels. First of all, there's an intense concern that some of these labs may be unsafe and could result in accidental releases that would be conceivably very harmful to communities that are around them. Second of all, I think because a number of the new laboratories that the United States is constructing to do biodefense work are being built, in fact, in a couple of cases, in the very same place where we do things like manufacture nuclear weapons, there's a great degree of concern that this is going to be destabilizing internationally. So you have groups like nonprofits around Lawrence Livermore Lab in Livermore, California, and Los Alamos Lab in New Mexico, who have been familiar with arms control issues for years because, of course, they've been fighting battles over production of nuclear weapons and nuclear waste, and now suddenly these labs are getting in on the bio business, and I think it's very unsettling, and it's also, frankly, unsettling for other countries because, you know, one of the things that practically everybody, the Bush administration excluded, want to see is for the Biological Weapons Convention to be stronger and for it to have declaration and verification measures, and the United States is making that more and more difficult with the degree of investment in its biodefense program, all of these labs all over the place, and frankly, the increase in the amount of secretive and classified work.
So it was a year or two back when I believe there was some interest across the country for universities and like institutions to seek out funding related to putting in a biological safety level 4 facility. And the University of Washington here in Seattle chose not to pursue that. Can you talk about that and what a BSL-4 facility is?
Sure. To begin with, a BSL-4 facility, it means biosafety level 4. It can also be referred to as maximum containment. These are the facilities that handle the most dangerous diseases for which cures are unavailable or which are very difficult. Generally speaking, biosafety level 4 facilities are for viruses and for, you know, the viral hemorrhagic fevers that people have heard about, things like Ebola. Now, having said that, we're building and, you know, we're multiplying several fold the amount of biosafety level 4 space in the United States, and frankly, the historic levels of research on level 4 agents aren't enough to come close to filling up the amount of lab space that we're building. And so there's another category of organisms which is appropriate to handle at biosafety level 4, and a number of organizations, mine included, is very concerned about this, and that's that if you start genetically engineering types of bugs that would normally require less containment, fewer safety measures, you may want to do that in a level 4 facility because of the inherent unpredictability of a lot of types of genetic engineering experiments. And of course, this potential result of the lab building boom that we're going to get into widespread genetic manipulation of very dangerous agents is something that is not only poses physical dangers to the folks that live around these facilities, but it is very disturbing internationally because, to put it in a very simple terms, what happens when the Iranians start genetically engineering anthrax and saying that it's a defensive activity? Are we going to accept that explanation, or are we going to bomb them? And so you get into rather extraordinary international security implications if you start up a program that does a lot of genetic modification of pathogens, and it looks like we're doing that precisely right now. What has happened in the last couple of years with the bidding process for new, very large biosafety level 4 labs is that there was a fight between a number of universities. The federal government was very eager to place a level 4 facility on the West Coast. The bidders were Oregon Health Sciences University and the University of California at Davis. The bid in Oregon never really got off the ground because, for various reasons. In the case of the University of California at Davis, there was enormous public opposition to constructing the lab there. And, in fact, it reached the point where the mayor of Davis, California, wrote to the National Institutes of Health and disinvited the lab. And although the university continued to want to build the lab, that effectively killed the plan to put it in Davis, and as a result, the lab was placed in Boston at Boston University. And in fact, right now and over the past few months, in Boston it is engendering the same type of community opposition that happened out in California. The other winner, so to speak, of the bidding process for a major BSL-4 facility was the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston.
And my understanding of why people didn't want to have a BSL-4 in their communities was primarily twofold. One, the danger of the materials that they would be working with in the lab, and the second was that the labs inevitably ended up getting funding and working on projects that were weaponization-oriented.
Yeah, there are a range of controversial activities that one can conduct. These are dual-use activities in these major high-containment facilities. To give you an example, if a researcher is interested in studying, say, transmission of anthrax, the researcher may decide that it's a good idea to prepare anthrax spores and to generate aerosols of them to spray on laboratory animals to see how the laboratory animals acquire infections, at what rate, with what number of spores, and so on. Now, that particular experiment will generate, perhaps, useful information for treating anthrax infections or for preventing anthrax infections when the studies are done on the lab animals that are infected. At the same time, that study involves preparation of spores in a manner which may be similar to what would be done to use the bug as a weapon, and it involves generation of aerosols, and of course, agent preparation and aerosolization are two key technology areas if you were going to go offensive. So the types of knowledge that are both generated and in fact, you know, proliferated in these kinds of experiments, because now instead of having a relatively small number of people interested in anthrax aerosols in the United States, now we have dozens of them, maybe even hundreds of people who are interested in doing this and would like to do this as a result of all the federal funding and the anthrax letters. So you can see with now we have more than 11,000 people registered in the United States to handle biological weapons agents, how we are potentially sowing the seeds of proliferation or even domestic terrorism through this massive expansion of the program.
Talk about, if you would, one of the offshoots of this massive increase in spending on biodefense appears to be an interest in the 1918 Spanish influenza virus. Can you talk about that?
Well, influenza, you know, when you first think about it, you think about a case of the flu, most people view it as being a nuisance, but not a particularly dangerous one. However, in fact, there are a fairly large number of people in the United States and around the world who are killed by influenza every year, particularly elderly or the very young or people who have a condition that renders the effects of influenza infection more severe. However, in the past and presumably in the future, periodically types of influenza emerge which are particularly devastating. And the 1918 influenza is obviously one of the most well-known and serious pandemics of disease that has occurred within living memory, or if not living memory, within the past century. And because technologies are also developing in which new types of influenza can reasonably easily be created in laboratories, including types that could be very dangerous, it is increasingly seen by the government as an important thing to learn the mechanisms of influenza pathogenicity, both for public health reasons, but in specifically in the context of the biodefense program, and that's where much of the funding for this type of influenza research is coming from, because of fears that it might be used as a weapon. Unfortunately, our biodefense program remains a bit schizophrenic about the influenza issue, because we are simultaneously funding the development of new threats, in the sense that we are funding the development of new techniques for the manipulation of influenza, which could be used in weapons, and the defense against those threats. And it's rather funny in a bit of a sad way. Right now, the National Institutes of Health, under the biodefense program, with money that it administers sort of on behalf of the Department of Homeland Security, is actually funding defenses against influenza which cite the same technology which NIH has also funded the creation of as being the threat. So it's a bit of the dog chasing its own tail.
Now, my understanding with this project to resurrect the 1918 virus, first off, that virus killed about 700,000 people here in the U.S. and 40 to anywhere upwards of 100 million worldwide.
Yeah, well, there are wildly varying figures, and frankly, they're only estimates about exactly how many bodies 1918 influenza left in its wake. I think it is it's safe to say 10 to 20 million, and may in fact be more globally. Interestingly, the project to recreate 1918 influenza began a bit as a technology in search of an application. The Armed Forces Institute of Pathology in Washington, a scientist named Jeffrey Taubenberger, developed a technique to rescue genes from archival samples and decided to apply these to 1918 influenza. This is several years ago, before the bioterrorism scare, because it was sexy, in effect. This is a sexy scientific topic. And so the original impetus came not from a perceived urgent public health need, because, of course, 1918 influenza is extinct, except in the laboratory. Rather, it came from a new biotechnology that was looking, or whose inventor was looking for a way to use it. And so, beginning several years ago, researchers from the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology and with collaborators began going through old tissue samples and literally exhuming victims of influenza in permafrost in Alaska, looking for all of the genetic material of the 1918 type in order to bring it back. Viewed from a health standpoint, there's a couple observations that you have to make. One, of course, it's a valid undertaking to try to determine why this particular type was so virulent, because a similar type could appear in the future. But that's not to say that it necessarily follows that you need to physically recreate this virus and disseminate it through various labs in the country. And unfortunately, the latter path was taken and is being taken, which is leading to 1918 types containing anything from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 genes of 1918, which is majority 1918, appearing in various facilities. And the concern, of course, is that as these constructs proliferate through laboratories, the chances of an accident increase. And in fact, now you hear talk of the development of a vaccine against 1918 influenza. Well, there would be no need for a vaccine against 1918 influenza were it not for the scientific experiments that are bringing it back. So there's a bit of a, let's say, a logical flaw in some people's approach to this problem, because they are, in effect, saying that they will address a problem that they themselves created. And if the bug simply were, if its genes were studied rather than bringing it back to life, we wouldn't need to be worried about how to treat it, because it wouldn't be there. It would, the infectious material simply wouldn't exist.
So clarify for me, they've recreated pieces of its DNA and then they are combining it with current known flus?
Yeah, the way that it works is that genes are reconstructed, and then those genes, through, there are a couple of different techniques to do it, and I'm not a virologist, so I won't attempt to explain them in detail, but those genes are then inserted into a contemporary type of influenza, and it is possible to essentially replace all of the genes of a contemporary influenza type, either one by one or through a different technique where you essentially get the genetic packages together and can bring them to life and bring back what is either the entire 1918 type, identical to the type that killed so many people nearly a century ago, or a type that's a hybrid of newer and the 1918 types. And to date, the scientists have gotten to the point of a type that is more than 50% 1918 influenza, and importantly, that contains the three key genes that are thought to relate to virulence.
So since they're creating basically something that is new, is a hybrid, is there a reasonable possibility that they could be creating something that is even more potent than the former virus?
Yes, I think it's possible. It is unlikely that it would be more potent than 1918 influenza. Very well could have about the same potency. What you're getting at, I think, or what we're getting at, is the inherent unpredictability of this type of research. And you can see parallels to this all across the biosciences. When you start inserting and removing genes, particularly the kind of genes that we're talking about in the 1918 experiments that relate to the virulence of the pathogen, the results can be very unpredictable. I think that, in fact, in terms of its virulence, it must be assumed, and I think that even the proponents of this type of research would readily admit, that with the constructs that currently exist, you have to presume that it has at least the virulence and infection potential of a 100% 1918 type. They would be foolish not to treat it that way.
Realizing that it would affect everybody differently, but as an example, from what I read, one of the samples where they had dug it up in Alaska, the village there, that 1918 virus had wiped out 85% of that village in a week.
Yeah, well, the thing about influenza and the reason, well, one of the reasons why it's so frightening to people in health, and one of the reasons why it would be a better biological weapon than might initially meet the eye, is its extraordinary transmissibility. Obviously, people hopefully know by now that an agent like anthrax is not transmitted from person to person. And there are other biological weapons agents that can be transmitted from person to person, but they don't necessarily do so easily. What is the case of influenza, however, is that it passes from person to person very rapidly, and to be frank, the escape of a 1918 type in the United States now, or for that matter in any other country, once it's very far out of the lab, the possibility of containing it is virtually nil, and the probability that it would go global is rather high.
So talk about, if you would, I understand the University of Washington here in Seattle is one of the places that's going to be working with this virus. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Well, the University of Washington in Seattle is more than just being one of the places that's going to work with 1918 influenza. It plans to conduct the most aggressive experiments with 1918 influenza that we know of. In fact, if there's anything more aggressive, it's classified. And what the University of Washington intends to do is to take 1918 types and aerosolize them on macaques at a facility in Seattle in order to observe the effects of the 1918 influenza on primates.
And they're going to be doing this at a facility that is currently a BSL level 2 that's being upgraded to a BSL level 3?
Yeah, the Sunshine Project became aware of the experiments that are to be conducted at the University of Washington when we asked the university for the minutes of its Institutional Biosafety Committee, called an IBC. And these IBCs, which exist at institutions nationally, are the primary committees that are in charge at the institution level of ensuring the safety of research. I was rather shocked when I got the minutes of the University of Washington committee and discovered that they were considering conducting these experiments with 1918 influenza at a biosafety level 3 facility. In fact, many experts in the field argue that the 1918 construct should not be taken out of biosafety level 4. But beyond that, what was rather remarkable was that the university was apparently encountering difficulty getting the U.S. Department of Agriculture to release the 1918 constructs to it because the facility that the University of Washington has simply is not built to the appropriate standard. And probably the most remarkable thing, one of the most remarkable things that I read in the minutes of any biosafety committee, and I've read minutes from a couple hundred committees across the country, was a decision by the University of Washington committee to declare that a non-existent facility would meet a rather stringent biosafety level in principle, and that they would approve experiments with 1918 influenza in principle without really looking at the experiments in appropriate detail, without developing appropriate safety protocols, in fact, without even having the lab completed and certified. I found that to be extraordinarily irresponsible.
Now, aren't there national standards for how these labs and experiments are justified?
Unfortunately, they're not. The way we go about this in the United States is that in the mid-70s, at the dawn of genetic engineering, the scientific community was very worried that there would be federal regulation of laboratory safety and of genetic engineering experiments. And in a conference at Asilomar in California, the science community effectively cut a deal with the federal government and said that they would create guidelines, not law, but non-binding guidelines, and this institutional biosafety committee system, and that science, in effect, would regulate itself and ensure safety in biotechnology experiments. So what we have now in the U.S. is that system, which has evolved over a couple of decades. The guidelines in the IBC system are managed by an office of the National Institutes of Health, but they continue to be effectively non-binding and voluntary. So while there are manuals and guidelines out there, the institutions that do this work, including the University of Washington, don't necessarily have to follow them.
So it sounds like then the individual institutions, in this case the University of Washington, gets to put together the committee that then decides whether the institution itself can handle these different experiments. Is that right?
Yeah, by and large, things operate at the level of the institution, and while there are theoretically public representatives on the committees, and there's a right to public access, in practice, it is very seldom used and very seldom really properly honored by the institution. So that's the reality that, we confront. There is no comprehensive national laboratory biosafety law, in that the United States is different than Europe, different than Japan, different than even China just enacted national laboratory biosafety law. We don't do that, and I think that the weaknesses of the regulatory approach or the non-regulatory approach in the U.S. are becoming more and more apparent as the biodefense program expands.
So maybe this is getting down into the nitty-gritty too much, but my understanding of back when they made the decision to allow working with this 1918 virus from a BSL-4 facility to a BSL-3 facility, was that the guy in charge had basically said that the mice he had injected, or however they transferred it to the mice, since they had been resistant to that virus by having Tamiflu, that now they knew that they could stop this virus with Tamiflu, and therefore, as long as any lab that was working with this had, you know, access to this drug, that everything would be okay.
Yeah, I mean, that, you've essentially, you know, hit the nail on the head. Really, the bottom line argument that researchers are advancing for the safety of working with 1918 influenza is that in very limited petri dish type experiments, 1918 constructs have been shown to be susceptible to Tamiflu, which is a commercial product made by Roche antiviral. It's made in one factory in Switzerland. To begin with, those are not clinically valid studies. Those are studies perhaps not even conducted by a medical doctor that were sort of used for internal purposes by some of these labs. So the argument is that if everyone has access to the lab is taking Tamiflu constantly, then they can't become infected. Okay? First of all, that's not really based on clinically valid studies. That's based on something that's a bit more than anecdotal, but not really something that you would want to bet the farm on. Secondly, there are more types of risks than a laboratory worker contracting the flu, which may be possible. For example, in Washington or in Seattle, you're talking about maintaining a population of 1918 infected monkeys. Monkeys are notorious sources of laboratory infections and also of the distribution of fluids that could be infectious through spitting, biting, scratching, throwing things around. So the scenario that can be imagined is if one, and I don't think that this is really medically or scientifically valid, even if one accepts that Tamiflu will prevent any laboratory-acquired infections, is that someone walks out of the lab with splashed with a substance that contains influenza, and that person, you know, infects a member of his family, and thereafter it becomes extraordinarily difficult to keep this bug from going global.
And that's not just some theory from a Stephen King novel. I understand there's plenty of examples of that happening in the past.
There's a debate that rages about this topic right now. The proponents and some of the managers of biosafety level 3 and level 4 facilities always say that they have a wonderful track record. And it's easy to say that you have a wonderful track record if there are no national reporting requirements for laboratory accidents. So, in other words, they say, well, you know, it doesn't happen very often that you have a laboratory-acquired infection. look, there's nothing in the medical literature, or there's very little in the medical literature. Well, yes, that's true. It's equally true that if you have accidents, you don't necessarily have to report them. So organizations like mine have been scrambling around now for a couple of years documenting laboratory accidents because the government doesn't do it. And laboratories don't like to draw attention to themselves by saying, hey, we had a problem here. All the incentives in the system are stacked against being fully transparent and accountable when it comes to people getting diseases in the lab. To give you a telling example, when the University of California at Davis wanted to build the Biosafety Level 4 lab, they could not obtain the support of the union that represented the folks that handle animals and do some of the technical work in the laboratories, and that was because those people were a bit upset at UC Davis's track record of laboratory-acquired infections. If you look in the literature and try to find out what has happened at UC Davis in terms of accidents, you're not going to find anything, but the people that actually do it in the union had a different perspective. But certainly, if you look back, you can find more examples. Another maybe telling example would be that typically if you hear people talk about smallpox and the eradication of smallpox in the wild, you will hear that the last human case of smallpox occurred in Somalia in 1977 or 1978. And this is not true. Actually, the last two human infections of smallpox occurred a year later in the United Kingdom as the result of a leakage from a laboratory. And in fact, one of those cases was fatal. And this type of thing happens with, by no means is it a daily occurrence, but it happens with frequency. There was a rather notorious accident in the mid-90s at Yale University when a researcher cracked a flask on a centrifuge in a lab and walked out the door with Brazilian hemorrhagic fever, and it wasn't caught for a couple of weeks until the researcher had to be hospitalized and actually treated with what were then experimental pharmaceuticals. So laboratory accidents happen, and they happen with some frequency. You know, when it comes to 1918 influenza, I guess the great fear in terms of safety is that it was originally created at one laboratory in Athens, Georgia. It's now, that we know of, at a laboratory in Winnipeg, Canada, at a laboratory in Madison, Wisconsin, is coming for some very dangerous types of experiments to the University of Washington in Seattle, and will probably continue to proliferate to other laboratories. And certainly if one looks at the recent experience, a death from Ebola, laboratory acquired in Russia, three laboratory escapes of SARS in the last 2 years, a needle stick with an Ebola needle that fortunately did not result in a case at Fort Detrick, the Army facility in Maryland, it would appear to be simply a matter of time before we have an accident involving influenza. And in fact, there is significant evidence that a global outbreak of a virulent type of influenza, not nearly as bad as 1918 influenza, that began in the 1970s, actually emerged from a laboratory in China.
My understanding, jumping back to Tamiflu, the only supposed known cure for this, I'm not sure if it's a cure or a prevention, but
it prevents the virus from reproducing. So it holds the virus in check while your immune system takes care of it, is my understanding.
I understand there's only a million doses of it in the U.S.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is a very serious issue, and the World Health Organization is concerned about it both in the context of potential laboratory accident and with what's happening in Asia with the bird flu. But were there to be a laboratory accident in which 1918 influenza escaped, it would be very, very difficult to control. And in fact, you know, if someone kisses their wife goodbye and she gets on a plane and goes to Bombay, it could be international very quickly. You know, the United States, we are one of the few countries in the world that stockpiles antivirals. We have enough for about 1 million people. Unfortunately, that's not nearly as many as we have Americans. And the situation generally gets worse as you look around the world. So there are a couple possibilities for a new major international pandemic of influenza. One is that the bird flu in Asia takes off. Another is that we have an accident involving 1918 influenza. Either way, both domestically and internationally, public health systems are not prepared to deal with it. And it seems to me, at least, to be rather crazy to subject ourselves to this additional threat of the 1918 influenza when, frankly, we don't have to in order to answer the kinds of questions that the researchers want answered. We're recreating it without any really valid reason to do so. And in turn, while that may generate honor and glory in a scientific sense for scientists, it may generate patents and perhaps some money, I don't believe that this small cadre of scientists should be allowed to move forward and pose these risks for the entire world in order to indulge their scientific aspirations in a way that really isn't even necessary in order to understand what it was about the 1918 influenza that made it so dangerous.
In fact, one of our two papers of record here in Seattle just did an editorial a few days ago praising the University of Washington for pursuing this work with the influenza virus and somehow tying in that by doing so it was going to solve the problem or potential problem of avian-based flu viruses.
Yeah, and this is the thing that I think that is important to understand because sometimes these issues get conflated. 1918 influenza is not the bird flu. In fact, they are not very closely related at all. And so, for example, a vaccine against 1918 influenza will do nothing or next to nothing for the bird flu and vice versa. Nor does research into the 1918 influenza do anything to solve the problems that everybody heard about the supply of influenza vaccine this year. They're wholly separate questions, and conflating them leads to confusion. But to be absolutely clear, exposing primates to 1918 influenza is not going to improve the supply of influenza vaccine, nor will it do anything to address the problem that may be emerging in Asia with the bird flu.
All right, so just to reiterate, from my readings, I've seen numerous experts question the wisdom of doing these type of experiments in something less than a BL level 4 facility, which we don't even have here in Seattle.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would say this. Look, there are two issues. One is whether the experiment should be conducted at all. And I fail to see any compelling scientific reason to recreate the 1918 influenza, and particularly to do things like aerosols on monkeys. That's the first issue. So first we should be asking ourselves, is this something that should be done at all, given in particular the possibility of an accidental release and the fact that we are encouraging other countries to create designer disease when we do things like this. That's one. Two is the issue of the appropriate level of containment. And it is absolutely the case that a number of experts in the field believe that if you're going to work with 1918 influenza, you must do so at a maximum containment facility. And you correctly note that there is no such facility at the University of Washington in Seattle. So I think that at more than one level, there is sound reason to question whether these experiments should go ahead.
Yeah, I have to say, I was pretty shocked to read about this information in the first place. And then I was doubly shocked to find out that the facility where they're going to be doing this at, I assumed would be on the campus somewhere, a remote location, hard to get to. But in fact, it turns out they're actually going to be doing it down on Western Avenue in Belltown, in a very populated portion of the city.
Yeah, you know, this issue has played out in many ways around the country. Of course, there are a lot of scientists that see a lot of glory and prestige in operating high containment facilities and in working with very dangerous bugs. I don't necessarily view these facilities as being very prestigious, but so be it. There are people that disagree, but you don't wish one of these facilities and this type of activity on anyone anywhere, whether it's out in the sticks or in a major metropolitan area. But having said that, certainly in the event of an accidental release of an easily transmissible agent like influenza, the likelihood that it's going to burn into the population fast and get uncontrollable fast is certainly much higher if you're doing this in a densely populated place.
How can people find out more about your organization?
Sure. Well, almost everything we do is on our website, and that's www.sunshine-project.org. So I would start there. We also have a written newsletter that you can sign up for on the website, and various list servers, either a general announcements list server or for folks who are particularly interested in biodefense and discussing experiments like the ones at the University of Washington. We have a biodefense list server, and I would encourage people to join that.
All right, because this does appear to be the new cash cow for the next century is biodefense, biotech.
Yeah, I don't foresee the biodefense appropriations going down for at least several years, so we will continue to see an expansion of this type of work. Although, you know, there are reasons for optimism. I think that at several labs or several places around the country, you've seen community groups come together and either, you know, send the lab packing, or I think probably more importantly for most of us, we've seen watchdog groups emerge that are keeping an eye on the activities of facilities and raising their voice and saying, hey, is this safe? Hey, is this a good idea? Hey, I want the minutes of your IBC meeting. Why can't I attend? And I think that this transparency and interaction with citizens groups can do a lot to keep the research safe and clean, above board. I think that researchers will think twice before conducting certain types of work, especially dual-use work, if the public is looking over their shoulders. And I think everything that can be done to have more of that happen is useful.
And, in fact, those IBC meetings are supposed to be open to the public. Is that correct?
The meetings of the Institutional Biosafety Committee are the minutes must be made available to the public, and the institutions are encouraged to open their meetings to the public. So if they're not open to the public, then the university should be asked why. At a minimum, the committee should provide you its minutes, and the committee should also have two representatives of the public on it, and the public should be able to interact with the committee minimally through those public representatives.
I can hear your lines disintegrating. So, Ed, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you very much. I was very happy to do it.